This is the Sean Hannity Show podcast.
What I think Mark is alluding to is what I said earlier, this notion of a conspiracy out there, and it gets wrapped up in concerns about the federal government. Now, there's a long history of that. That's in our DNA. You know, the United States was born suspicious of some distant authority.
But let me just jump in. Is it fair to call it a conspiracy? I mean, there's a lot of people really believe this deeply, that they just don't.
They just don't
trust you.
I'm sorry, Cooper. Yes, it is fair to call it a conspiracy. What are you saying? Are you suggesting that the notion that we are creating a plot to take everybody's guns away so that we can impose martial law
is a conspiracy?
Yes, that is a conspiracy. I would hope that you would agree with that. Is that controversial? Except on some websites around the country?
There are certainly a lot of people who just have a fundamental distrust that you do not want to go further and further and further down this road.
Look, I'm only going to be here for another year. I don't know. When would I have started on this enterprise, right? So, yes, it is a false notion that I believe is circulated for either political reasons or commercial reasons in order to prevent a coming together among people of goodwill to develop common sense rules that will make us safer while preserving the Second Amendment.
All right, that was the president with Grouper, the host, last night on his big town hall on guns. And as the AP has pointed out, we pointed out, you know, this was supposedly all brought about because of recent terror attacks, but not a single terror attack or a single incident of gun violence in recent weeks and years would have been prevented by anything that the president is proposing. Now we have this latest incident today. You got a gunman. We've got the video we'll show you tonight on Hannity, who ambushes. And it's the most chilling video you're ever going to watch of a Philadelphia police officer as the guy sitting there in his marked cruiser. You know, according to investigators, he said he did this in the name of Islam, another terrorist attack. I guess 6 years from now, we'll say it's not work-related violence. But the suspect, dressed as a Muslim, waved the cruiser down on a street. The cruiser pulled over. Police commissioner pointed out the suspect fired at least 13 shots, mostly point blank range, at this officer. It's a miracle this man is alive. Anyway, the officer was even able to, after being hit, return fire, hit his attacker at least three times. Anyway, he had pledged, this 30-year-old shooter had pledged allegiance to ISIS. Now, what if the cop didn't have a gun? What if he would be dead today? It would be over. It's a miracle he survived as it is. And it turns out that there's nothing, apparently, we're told, according to early reports here, that the gun, it's been confirmed, was a stolen weapon. Nothing that Obama has proposed would have stopped this. Just like all the incidents, like San Bernardino and Newtown and all the other examples that we talk about. The president keeps talking about this again and again and again, but not one thing that he has proposed would have stopped any of these recent incidents. And, of course, terror is on the rise. Anyway, here to discuss and debate all this, John Lott is the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, author of the best-selling book With All the Facts. If you haven't read it, it's worth reading. More Guns, Less Crime. I think it's now in its 15th edition. Gail Trotter is a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum and an attorney at Schaefer and Trotter. Welcome all of you to the program.
Great to be with you, Sean.
All right, so let me ask you, I mean, is this not the latest example where the president's feel-goodism isn't going to work again?
Well, it's worse than that. You know, it's you're correct that it wouldn't have stopped any of these mass public shootings that he's using to motivate trying to pass these laws or these rules. But these rules that he wants to have make it costly for law-abiding citizens to have guns for protection. So you're in New York City. These expanded background checks that New York City has and the state has there at about $125 under the price of transferring a gun. The cheapest gun dealer that you can find in New York City to transfer a firearm will charge you $125. Others will charge you even more. That won't maybe stop you or I from buying a gun, but the people that my research indicates benefit the most from owning guns poor, law-abiding blacks who live in high-crime urban areas, the people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime, some of them are surely going to be priced out of having the option to defend themselves.
You actually knew Obama at the University of Chicago, and you talk about in one of your books that you actually met Obama and that Obama told you, I don't believe people should own guns, and apparently you guys were supposed to have a lunch together, if I recall. What happened?
Right. Well, we overlapped for about 4 years at the University of Chicago Law School. We were both teaching there at the same time when he was a part-time lecturer. And the first time I went up, I introduced myself, and he said, oh, you're the gun guy. And I said, well, I guess so. And he just turned to me and looked me straight in the face and said, I don't believe people should be able to own guns. And I know, you know, I'd heard that he had been working with the city of Chicago on their suit against the gun makers, but I said, look, why don't we get together for lunch sometime and we can talk about it? And he just turned his back on me and walked away. And that was the end of our first conversation. And we probably ran into each other or had interactions maybe about 24 times or so, but it was pretty much the same thing. It was, you know, he not only disagreed with me, but you could tell that he really disliked me because of our different views on the issue there. And it's, you know, I don't think I was the only one he treated that way. If he disagreed with you, it was kind of like he viewed you as evil.
All right, let's talk about the facts, because this is what your book, More Guns, Less Crime, what edition of printing is it in now? And I know you've updated it over the years. What edition now are you in?
The third edition came out in 2010.
Okay, and that's the latest updated edition. But you have gone through real numbers, real statistics, and that's why the book is entitled More Guns, Less Crime. Let's talk about right. What the truth is. Take the emotion out of it. I saw the crocodile tears of the president the other day, and I'm like, I'm not believing it, because it's the same guy after James Foley got beheaded, gave a one-minute press conference, and didn't want to be late for his tea time. So I'm not exactly right. Convinced that these are real tears. And, you know, we've had all this violence in Chicago over the years, and he hasn't uttered a word on it for the most part, except maybe two or three times, and only recently. So explain why right. More guns, because this goes against, you know, oh, look, if you have a gun, you're more likely to shoot yourself or a family member. That's what the typical liberal talking point.
Right. No, well, look, just as you can deter criminals with higher arrest rates or higher conviction rates, the fact that a would-be victim might be able to defend themselves makes it riskier for criminals to go and do the attack. And the thing is, last night we had a woman who was a rape victim, was asking the president why he wanted to make it difficult for people to own a gun. She was saying in her own case she didn't want to be a victim again.
Well, let me play that, because I think this is a very important moment from last night. As a matter of fact, this woman is going to join us on Hannity on the TV show tonight. Here's how it went down.
As a survivor of rape and now a mother to two small children, you know, it seems like being able to purchase a firearm of my choosing and being able to carry that wherever me and my family are, it seems like my basic responsibility as a parent at this point. I have been unspeakably victimized once already, and I refuse to let that happen again to myself or my kids. So why can't your administration see that these restrictions that you're putting to make it harder for me to own a gun or harder for me to take that where I need to be is actually just making my kids and I less safe?
Well, Kimberly, first of all, obviously, you know, your story is horrific. The strength you've shown in telling your story and you know, being here tonight is remarkable, and so really proud of you for that. I just want to repeat that there's nothing that we've proposed that would make it harder for you to purchase a firearm. And now, you may be referring to issues like concealed carry, but those tend to be state-by-state decisions, and we're not making any proposals with respect to what states are doing. They can make their own decisions there. So there really is no nothing that we're proposing that prevents you or makes it harder for you to purchase a firearm if you need one. There are always questions as to whether or not having a firearm in the home protects you from that kind of violence. And I'm not sure we can resolve that. People argue at both sides.
How do you answer that, John Lott?
Well, I think it's pretty clear, particularly for somebody like a woman who's relatively weaker physically. You know, we have something called the National Crime Victimization Survey that's looks at about 100,000 people each year, and they've been doing this for almost 40 years now. And you can break it down in different ways. You look at people who have been victims of crime. They asked how they respond, what's the outcome, whether the criminal was armed or unarmed, what crime they were type of being committed. And what you find consistently year after year is that by far the safest course of action for victims to take is to have a gun. It's particularly true for people who are relatively weaker physically, women and the elderly, and people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime. I mean, the police are important. I think the police are the single most important factor for reducing crime. But if you talk to police themselves, they understand that they virtually always arrive on the crime scene after the crime's occurred. And one of the reasons why police are the, among the strongest supporters of people being able to own guns is they know themselves in their own lives how important guns are to them in being able to defend themselves. And they realize that victims need to do something before the police are able to arrive there on the scene.
You know, Gail, as I listen to John and listen to the president last night, you know, the magic words come out, I've never owned a gun. Well, I've been around weapons since I'm a kid, and I've had a pistol carry permit in Rhode Island, California, Alabama, Georgia, and New York. I've carried it more than half my adult life. And I'm thinking, okay, this president has enough armed guards, as every president should have, every politician
right.
should have. But, you know, it's amazing the difficulty, for example, in a city like New York or a state like New York, that it is to be able to carry a weapon to protect yourself, Gail.
Yes, and you might have noticed last night during the town hall, he mentioned that he wasn't really around guns where he spent his childhood in Hawaii. And then he talked later on about being from Illinois and how down in the southern part of Illinois, it's closer to Kentucky where there's a lot of sportsmanship and hunting. And so he became familiar with that aspect of it from being in Illinois. And yet, as we mentioned earlier, Chicago has a very high homicide rate. And when we put in these gun control regulations that limit the ability of people in dangerous, disadvantaged neighborhoods from easily and cheaply being able to afford protection for themselves, then the president is ignoring the place where law-abiding citizens having firearms to prevent crime can be most effective at lowering the homicide rate. And I think it's really important to look at these statistics from the Department of Justice, which show that over 90% of violent crime in America happens without guns. So in most circumstances, when someone is being attacked by a violent assailant, the violent assailant does not have a firearm. So if the victim, if the potential victim, the law-abiding citizen, could have a firearm and not have it be so expensive that it's only limited to the elites in our society, then they have the ability to turn the tables on the violent attacker, to reverse the balance of power, because then they have a fighting chance to defend themselves. And studies have shown that people who are citizens have a lot of experience and training with firearms, even more so in a lot of cases than police officers on, you know, going to the gun range and making sure that they are able to operate the firearm when they need to. And another important statistic is that less than 1% of defensive gun uses is anybody injured or killed. So you think about just having the firearm in the house, if the criminals know that people have weapons to defend themselves, then the risk of the attack goes up significantly. And if they end up breaking into the house, the sight of a firearm or hearing anything related to it could scare them away. And that's what we want to allow citizens to be able to do, because police can't be there fast enough. Police can't be everywhere. And we especially understand that with the threat of radical Islamic terrorism going on right now. If we allow people to have firearms, they'll be able to defend themselves in places that the cops can't go.
As Sarah Palin pointed out, for a president that is so obsessed with people owning guns, why would he give, you know, why would he allow illegal immigrant criminals back out on the street? There's 121 murders that took place. Or why would he give the Iranians nuclear weapons? Or why would he put 600 Gitmo detainees, you know, some, what, 35% of them go back into the battlefield? Makes no sense. But, all right, thank you both for being with us. John Lott, Gail Trotter, appreciate it. 800-941-SHAWN, our toll-free telephone number. Governor, former Governor Wilder of Virginia, not a fan of Obama. We'll find out if he supports Hillary when we get back. We'll get back into the very latest on this ISIS-inspired attack in Philly. Try to assassinate a cop earlier today. We have that video for you tonight at 10.
Hannity Headlines. A bite-sized version of the show that you can take with you everywhere you go. To sign up today for Hannity Headlines, go to Hannity.com.
This is the Sean Hannity Show.
And some of them I really like, and some of them I really respect. You don't respect everybody. You can't. We are going to build a wall. Don't worry about it. And wait a minute. And who's going to pay for the wall? Who's going to pay for the wall? Who's going to pay for the wall? I've never done that before. That's actually true.
All right, 25 now till the top of the hour. Who's going to pay for the wall? Anyway, Mexico. And a chant that Donald Trump led at his, what was that, the Vermont rally? Unbelievable. 20,000 people showed up in the freezing cold for that rally. Former governor of the great state, purple state of Virginia, Doug Wilder, is with us. How are you?
Fine indeed, Sean. Good to be with you again. Good to have joined you in New York. I enjoyed being with you.
It was a lot of fun. Now, you're not an Obama supporter. Are you a Hillary supporter?
Well, I haven't supported anyone in this election cycle as at this point, so I'm on record as being like a lot of people, waiting to see what happens.
Are you open to a Republican?
I'm open to what's in the best interest of the people of America at this time.
Does that mean yes? Can I take that as you're open, meaning open?
You can take it to mean that it's open to what.
You sounded like a politician. You
American people.
You gave that up a long time ago, but.
Well, what it means, Sean, quite frankly, is that I don't rule anything in or anything out. I have been criticized considerably for people believing that because I have run as a Democrat, been elected as a Democrat, that I have to support every Democratic candidate that comes along. I didn't do that in Virginia, and President Obama didn't particularly like it when I did not support one of the fellows who was running for governor. Now, having said that, this doesn't mean that I have got to proclaim whom it is. And I will say to you that I'm going to be very concerned about this election cycle, who is going to be there, and I do plan to publicly, strongly endorse someone.
60+% of Americans think that Hillary Clinton is dishonest, not truthful, and that she's a liar, basically. Every poll bears this out. Do you think she's honest and trustworthy?
I haven't had occasion to pass on that, but I do think this. It's very important for people to have representing them those who put the interest of the public first. And you and I have talked about this.
Yeah, I want to say, look, I'm in the point where in my life, and I think you're in the same spot because we talk both on and off air.
That's correct.
I don't like seeing 94.5 million Americans out of the labor force and then the government lying to us, telling us that unemployment's better. It's just a lie.
Here's the way I look at it. I think government of people, by the people, and for the people, by the people, should mean just that. Not for the elected officials. One of the things that you're seeing this year, bigger than you've ever seen before, and the piece you just played here just a moment or so ago in Vermont shows that the public is fed up with government, period. They don't care whether it's Republican or Democrat or what have you. They're interested in someone who's going to be for them. And this is what I'm trying to say to you. I want to be supporting someone who I am convinced is really committed to serving the public rather than the public serving them.
All right, let's then look at the phenomenon. This is the year of the insurgent, the year of the outsider. I mean, Donald Trump's crowds remind me of the crowds Obama got back in 07 and 08. I mean, they're massive. No other candidate is getting crowds like this. What?
I talked with a mutual friend of ours this morning, Larry Sabatino. And he told me to tell you hello. And I'll say this. I have never seen anything like it as it relates to the crowds that are coming. And when the people are saying, well, Trump will disappear, he'll go away, that hasn't happened. So you have to consider, one, is Donald Trump going to be the nominee of the party? If so, what effect will that have as far as Hillary is concerned? Will Bill Clinton being in the race be a part of something that can be seized upon by Trump to show that Hillary's position with women isn't as sound as she has proclaimed it to be? And then, moreover, if Trump is not the nominee, who will that person be? I think, quite frankly, the possibilities of Trump being the nominee are looming more positive than ever before. Having said that, I do think that there are formidable candidates there. Ted Cruz is formidable. Marco Rubio is formidable. Who of those three do you think Hillary Clinton would rather run against?
I don't know the answer to that, because here's what the unknown, here's the question that's going to be answered only by the voters. And that is, does Trump support, does it run deeper than what the polls show? In other words, some people might, you know, they're questioned by a pollster, and they might not, I'm not going to tell you who
it's a very good observation.
Okay. The second observation is maybe it's thinner than, you know, maybe people at the last minute, they'll get timid, oh, I'm afraid, you know, to really follow through with the outsider.
I agree with that.
So that's a possibility.
Right.
I think it's just an unknown at this point, and the voters are going to tell us how they feel.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think, moreover, you have to couple the economy with all of that. Are the jobs there? Has there been a fall off from the euphoria accompanying the Obama administration, the Obama elections? Yes. Is that ripple effect being felt? Yes. Will Hillary be able to crank that vote up? That's an issue that's still out there to be answered.
Let me give you some numbers on the economy, because I think it's going to be a big factor. People always vote their pocketbooks. Peace and prosperity drive elections. You know, the government tells us now unemployment's down to 5%, but of course they use a special Washington, D.C. abacus because, you know, you can't come up with a genuine unemployment number, but you eliminate the chronically unemployed in that number. So the number's phony. We have 94.5 million Americans out of the labor force. You've got a growing number of men ages 25 to 54 out of the labor force. You have less educated people likely to claim illness or disability as a reason for not working. On top of that, 17% of the labor force now is immigrants in this country. That's a big number. And we have the legal immigration is a bigger issue than I think anyone anticipated. Add to that 50 million Americans in poverty, 46 million Americans on food stamps, median income under Obama's down nearly $5,000 a family. And then you've got on top of that, a president that will accumulate more debt than every other president before him combined.
One thing you left out.
Help me out.
The unemployment rate in the African-American community.
It's higher.
Is higher. And that is what people are saying in the streets. Look, people are enthused about having Obama being elected president. They're happy about it. The ultimate question becomes, though, what has it meant and what does it mean? For me, and I can tell you that it's a very interesting dynamic out there, and as it relates to the people and the effect government has had on the people, it's going to be, you got a lot of things out there.
But imagine that, 50 million Americans in poverty. That's
right.
You know, where did you grow up? I grew up in Long Island.
Richmond, Virginia.
Okay, you grew up in Richmond. Now,
son of Virginia, don't forget.
I know that. All right, so did you have jobs in your teenage years? I had a million jobs as a teenager.
Sure I did. I shined shoes. I painted signs on buildings. Washed windows around the street. I carried newspapers. I did everything.
So now we're at a point where, if you want to break it down demographically, which you did, that 50% of black teenagers in America can't get a summer job. Now, if you didn't have a summer job and I didn't have a summer job, why do I suspect that you would have been like me and we both would have been getting into trouble?
Oh, yeah. And we were told that at home. See, one of the things that we've left out also in this regard, Sean, is the absence of family, the absence of people in the community taking the place of family. When there were no fathers at home, when there were no mothers, and that's disappearing, unfortunately. It's gone. And so a lot of the kids are out. Look at the millennials today. They're not distraught. They're not upset. They are disconnected because they have no idea, in many instances, where they are and how they got where they are and what opportunities were not there for people like myself. And how we overcame them. This is what I try to describe in the book, how we overcame them, and we never allowed anything to stop us from believing in that high possibility of the individual.
I think government in general, and I'm speaking about Republicans too. Believe it or not, I'm angrier at Republicans than I am a Democrat.
I can understand that.
Because I think they've been timid. They've been weak. They, you know, Obama's rolled them time and time again. They won't use their constitutional authority, the power of the purse. I don't like executive overreach with these executive actions because the president can't get done things legislatively, so he just does it by executive fiat. That bothers me. Republicans don't stand up to him or defund it. That bothers me. But at the end of the day, those numbers I gave you, about 50 million Americans, 94.5 million Americans, 46 million Americans, median income down, debt, record debt, I'm thinking, you know, this is a catastrophe.
Here's something we've left out, both of us have, and that is the high cost of education today. Is it necessary to spend that kind of money to get a college education?
Well, don't go to an expensive college then. Go to a community college.
Well, I understand, but go to some college.
I agree.
Go to some school. If you can't afford to go to school, get a job. If you can't afford to get the best job, get some job.
Any job.
Any job. Help yourself. Pull yourself up. Do all of the kinds of things that are necessary, and then to the extent that government assists in those regards, fine. But you cannot depend on
government. Yeah, but look how poor government has done in terms of educating our kids now. You know, America.
Don't even go there because it's a mess. Now, when you go there, Sean, you got to be careful because most of those decisions are made at the local levels.
Yeah, but the problem is government sets. You know, it's a top-heavy, top-down approach. I'll give you an example. We're spending almost $20,000 per kid in New York on education, mm-hmm. and they come out dumber than when they went in.
I understand.
You know, it's a sad commentary.
It is not.
There's an answer.
Necessarily related to money. It's related to what you do with the money that is expended on behalf of education. Well, is that money being put in the classroom? Is that money being put in the academics? Is it to improve the curriculum? Are you attracting the best qualified people, not only to teach, but to administer? And if not, why not?
Here's the biggest thought from my head, though. If you took that money and gave every kid a check, don't you think schools would become competitive for those dollars? We're talking about billions of dollars now. State, local, federal dollars on education. You give parents a voucher. Where are they going to send their kids to school? The schools that have discipline? The schools that actually teach? The schools that you know, put kids in uniforms and make them sit up straight and put an apple on the teacher's desk and shut up and learn?
I have seen the effects of some of the charter schools that were funded,
yeah,
similar to what you spoke
about. Yeah, like in New York, they've had good success with
charter schools. Rather than, I'm not speaking about the vouchers. And yet, you and I know that there is a group that offends, that they're offended by that. They don't want that group. And yet, if you went into those communities and asked those people,
yep,
many of them support the very things that you and I are talking about. So, no, it's there.
Well, disproportionately, inner city kids are hurt the most.
I think in that regard, you're right. And that's when you get back to what's going on.
I think you and I should run as a ticket. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I think you're doing far better than that, what you're doing now. The other thing that we need to look at is look at Chicago. Look at Chicago at its system of education. Look at the jobs. Look at what's happening with the mayor down there. Look at, that's the president's hometown.
Yeah, and how many times, and the president cried this week, and I'm watching it and I'm saying, you know, years ago on my TV show, Governor, you know, when the president's speaking out about Michael Brown, Trayvon Martin, you know what I did? I took the names of people that nobody ever heard of that were killed in Chicago that the president never mentioned. Now, all of a sudden, the eighth year into his presidency, now he's going to mention Chicago.
Well, but mentioning it is one thing, but when you have the former chief of staff,
yeah,
of the president,
corrupt,
in his hometown, overseeing things that are coming out today that are showing a lack of efficiency, a lack of proficiency. And so this is why I've been a mayor of a city. I've been governor of a state, and I do know what needs to take place. And that's why, I point out in my book that we are Americans, which makes us different from any other group of people. We have the opportunities. We've had the advantages to build upon what sacrifices that have been made on our behalf,
agreed,
and yet we need to take more of it.
I got a roll. Governor Wilder, we always love having you on. Good
Talk
to
about my book now, Son of Virginia.
Son of Virginia, written by Governor Wilder. It's a great book. I read it.
Thank you very much.
I interviewed you about the book. I figured we'd talk about something else this time. Otherwise, it's the same interview as last time.
I don't have a problem with that, and we're going to talk some more anyway. We do quite frequently.
Well, I'll even put your book on my website. How's that?
That's what I want.
And I'll give a high recommendation for people to get it.
Thank you very much, Sean.
All right, Governor.
God bless.
God bless you.